Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Intellectual Property Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, May 26, 2017, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon, we'll hear about the T.C. Heartland v. Kraft Foods Group brand's Supreme Court decision. My name is Laura Flint. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are happy to have with us Mr. William J. Brown, Jr., Managing Partner at Brown & Wagner, and Professor J. Devlin Hartline, Assistant Director at the Center for the Protection of Intellectual Property and Adjunct Professor at the Antonin Scalia Law School at George Mason University. Both of the speakers today signed on to amicus briefs on opposite sides of this case. I will turn it over to Professor Hartline to get us started. After opening remarks, we'll go to audience question and answer. Thank you for speaking with us. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Laura, and thank you to the Federalist Society for hosting us, and thanks to Bill Brown for taking time to discuss this important opinion with me. As you mentioned, Bill and I were on opposite sides of this case, going into the Supreme Court, but having talked with Bill the past few days, I think there's much that we agree on now that the opinion is out, but we don't agree on everything, so hopefully it will make for an interesting discussion. I'm just going to briefly discuss the issue and the court's holding and the court's reasoning, and then I'll explain briefly why I don't think the court's reasoning is persuasive. So in the case, T.C. Heartland versus Kraft Foods, the issue before the Supreme Court was where a patent owner can sue a domestic corporation for patent infringement. And while all the federal district courts have power to hear patent infringement suits, there are rules about where a particular case has to be filed. These are called venue rules. So we have the patent venue rule, which is in Section 1400B, that provides that a patent infringement suit against a domestic corporation can be brought anywhere that it, quote, resides. Then we have the general venue rule in Section 1391C that defines the residency of a domestic corporation very broadly, in fact, to the full extent of the due process clause. So the Supreme Court was asked to decide whether that broad definition in the general venue rule applies to the word resides in the patent venue rule. And the courts below, the district court and the federal circuit, both held that it does, giving patent owners lots of choices where they can sue for infringement. But the Supreme Court unanimously, 8-0, held that it does not. And the Supreme Court announced a rule that a domestic corporation resides for venue purposes only in its state of incorporation. So to understand how the court got there, we have to go back in time to 1957 in a case called Forco Glass, and the Supreme Court addressed this very same issue, the interplay of the patent venue rule and the general venue rule. And the court there in Forco Glass held that Section 1400B, the patent rule, is, quote, the sole and exclusive provision controlling venue in patent infringement actions, and it is not to be supplemented by Section 1391C. So the court thus held that a domestic corporation only resides in its state of incorporation. Fast forward 60 years to T.C. Heartland, this case, and the court saw no reason to change course. It said that while the patent venue rule hasn't changed since Forco Glass, 1400B is exactly the same as it was then, but the general venue rule has been amended twice. So Section 1391C was first amended in 1988 to broadly define where a corporation resides for purposes of venue under this chapter. And then 2 years later, the Federal Circuit famously in VE Holding said that this change was so significant that Forco Glass was no longer good law and a patent owner could sue a domestic corporation in places other than its state of incorporation. So 1391 was again amended in 2011. And this time it stated twice that its broad definition of residency governs venue in, quote, all civil actions and, quote, for all venue purposes. And this led the Federal Circuit here to reiterate what it had said in 1990 in VE Holding, that resides in the patent venue statute should be interpreted broadly. But the Supreme Court, in an opinion by Justice Clarence Thomas, disagreed. The court said that its narrow view of residency that it had announced in 1957 in Forco Glass remains the law today, despite these amendments to 1391C. And Justice Thomas, as we all know, a textualist, reasoned that the changes to the general venue rule in 1391C do not evince congressional intent to overrule Forco Glass. The version of 1391C that applied then, just like the one that applies now, applies to, quote, all actions. So Justice Thomas stated that, given the court's holding in Forco Glass, Congress, quote, ordinarily provides a relatively clear indication of its intent in the text of the amended provision. And he reasoned that 1391C does not contain any indication that Congress intended to alter the meaning of 1400B. So turning to what I think about the case, I find this textual analysis perfunctory. So I don't think it's persuasive. And as I mentioned earlier, Justice Thomas is a textualist. And if you look at the text of 1391, it seems that he's ignoring the clear import of what it says. So twice, 1391 says that it applies in all cases, but apparently all doesn't mean what it used to mean. And Justice Thomas focuses on the saving clause, which is found in 1391A. It says, except as otherwise provided by law. And Justice Thomas said, well, this means that there are exceptions, and so it stands to reason that the exception here is 1400B, just like we said in Forco Glass. But I don't think this is the proper way to read the saving clause. So the version of 1391C that existed in Forco Glass was a substantive venue rule. It actually established the rule of where a corporation could be sued. But the version of 1391C that exists today and that existed in 1988 before the Federal Circuit ruled in VE Holding, it's purely definitional. It's no longer a substantive rule. All that 1391C does is define residency. And it says on its face that that definition is to be applied elsewhere. Where else? Well, everywhere else. It says all civil actions, all venue purposes. The residency definition applies whenever such a definition is needed in a federal venue statute. And that, of course, includes 1400B, which turns on residency, but it doesn't define the term. So the two venue rules that were at issue in Forco Glass, they were contradictory. We had two statutes that substantively said, this is where venue lies. And so only one could apply. And I think the Supreme Court got it right in Forco Glass, that we're going to apply the special venue statute. But the problem is that the statute that exists today in 1391C, there is no more conflict. And in fact, 1391C reads itself into 1400B in perfect harmony. So Justice Thomas, the textualist, could only arrive at his conclusion, I think, by ignoring the text. And interestingly, it's the fact that he didn't look to legislative history that I think threw him off. So it was, if you go back to Forco Glass and read the case, the court says that it was relying heavily on the revisor's notes, not on the text of the clause itself, but on what was written about it by the people who wrote the law. And that led the court to rule the way that it did. So the court reasoned that the 1948 amendment to 1391C did not change the meaning in 1400B because that's what it said in the revisor's notes, that Congress did not intend a substantive change to the law. But here we have Justice Thomas not mention that fact, and he doesn't look at the legislative history. But if the court had looked at the legislative history, it would have seen indications that Congress did intend to change the law. And this was true in 1988, and it's true for the 2011 amendment. For example, the House report to the 2011 amendment explicitly says that 1391C is, quote, applicable universally, and applies, quote, to all venue statutes, including venue provisions that appear elsewhere in the United States Code. And if you look at the report from the American Law Institute, the ALI, which actually drafted the language that Congress ultimately adopted, it reiterates this point. It says, quote, all of the definitions of residence set forth in 1391C apply globally to all venue statutes, whether of general or special applicability, that use residence of the parties to define venue. So we have ALI and Congress with the 2011 amendment saying that they were trying to solve problems that had arisen. They created this definitional section to solve problems, such as suing an unincorporated entity, such as an LLC or an association, or what do we do about foreign corporations? And if you read the T.C. Heartland opinion, the court recognizes that its narrow view of resides in 1400B creates a problem for foreign corporations. Where can you sue them? It doesn't answer that question, but it says that's an issue. It's in a footnote. And the same thing with an unincorporated entity like an LLC. In another footnote, the court recognizes the problem, but it doesn't give us an answer. Well, I think the answer is clear that Congress already solved this problem when it passed 1391C in 2011, and this is, again, indicated in the ALI, and it's indicated in the history. If we just use the definitions in 1391C the way they're supposed to, then we won't have these problems of where does venue lie for foreign corporations or LLCs and the like. And with that, I will turn it over to Bill for his analysis.
Here I am. I'm on. Thank you, Professor Heartland, for the introduction and discussion. I think that this is a difficult textual issue to grapple with. And I think if you just read Justice Thomas's opinion that came out this week, it really simplifies the issue. But when you go back and look at the issues to be grappled with, both on a policy level and from a textual interpretation level, it's a close case and it's a hard case to decide. And that's not entirely clear from the decision. And from my standpoint, the brief that I wrote was on behalf of the Orange County Intellectual Property Law Association. And that association, as my client, was certainly not internally unanimous about what position it wanted to take. In fact, it wanted to take different positions at different times. So I might have been in the position of writing a brief that agreed with Devlin here. And so I looked at both of the issues. And from a textualist standpoint, I think it is there are some difficulties that are there. But I think if you dive a little bit below the surface, I think there's something more to Justice Thomas's opinion. There's more to be found there, and I'm gonna address that. I think again, going back to the start of this, in patent cases, the question here is under one interpretation of the statute, section 1391 provides the definition of residence for a corporation, such that if a corporation has minimum contacts with a district, that's sufficient to establish venue. And on another definition, the definition under section 1400 that has remained virtually unchanged for at least since 1948 when it was recodified and even longer than that. Under that definition, in a patent case, a corporation can only be sued where it's been incorporated. And so that's a very narrow definition. And I think when you step back and you look at this case, I think what is really notable when you look at the holding of the case as it came down, and I'll just read from what I thought was really notable here on several levels. I'm going to read from the Supreme Court opinion right at the end of the introduction from Justice Thomas. He says, we conclude that the amendments to section 1391, and those were the amendments in 2011. So we conclude that the amendments to section 1391 did not modify the meaning of section 1400B as interpreted by Forco. And Forco was the 1957 case that Devlin mentioned. And he goes on, he said, we therefore hold that a domestic corporation resides only in its state of corporation for purposes of the patent venue statute. Now, that's straightforward and clear enough. But what I want to do is go back to the Federal Circuit's decision. And the Federal Circuit's decision was a panel decision, 3-0, with no dissent. And remember, the Supreme Court, what I just read, was 8-0. And so the Federal Circuit opinion, I'm just going to read real briefly from that. It says, Heartland, who was the petitioner, asks us to presume that the 2011 amendments Congress codified the Supreme Court's Forco decision regarding patent venue that was in effect prior to the 1988 amendments. So what the Federal Circuit is saying is essentially what the holding was right here. And the Federal Circuit in the next sentence goes on to say, we find this argument to be utterly without merit or logic. And so what the Federal Circuit decided, they said it was just completely devoid of merit or logic, but nonetheless, the Supreme Court takes the same issue, looks at it, and unanimously, 8-0, finds the opposite. And that seems like it's a very seems like a stark slapdown for the Federal Circuit there. And it seems that the Federal Circuit is out of touch on this issue. And from looking at it myself, I looked at it and went back to the Federal Circuit's decision previously at this issue, and I couldn't find a whole lot of flaw with it, except that they were too focused on the amendments themselves rather than looking at the statute as a whole. And I think that that's where we find support for Justice Thomas's decision as written here. So I was surprised that it was an 8-0 decision because I think there's a little more to be found there. Another comment I want to make on this is what the impact this case is going to have on patent litigation. Obviously, this dramatically restricts where cases can be filed. And what's notable is that Eastern District of Texas has a disproportionately high number of the cases that are filed there, and that was a point of a lot of the complaints that practitioners and companies had. And what's notable is from looking at docket reports from the Docket Navigator, just this week since the case has come down, the T.C. Heartland case came down, there have been no cases filed in the Eastern District of Texas, which seems extraordinary based on the number of cases and the rate of cases that have been filed in the past. Usually you have several cases filed every day, and so we've gone the rest of this week without any filed there. That may be notable. And then there's also a question as to what's going to happen to several hundred cases that could be potentially subject to motions to change venue or subject to motions to dismiss for improper venue. And so those issues have yet to be worked out. And there's some indication, at least, that several judges in trial court cases have issued sua sponte orders asking parties to brief the issue as to how the T.C. Heartland case is going to impact the venue in those cases. The other thing I want to comment on is on the textualism aspect of this case. What Justice Thomas focused on was the question of whether the change in the 2011 statute to Section 1391, and I'll just review what those changes were. One of the changes they made was instead of using the language that existed in 1998, it said, for purposes of venue under this chapter, and the Federal Circuit had read that in Section 1391 to modify Section 1400. So it said, for purposes of venue under this chapter, a defendant that is a corporation shall be deemed to reside in any district in which it's subject to personal jurisdiction. And in 2011, they had added at the beginning in Section A, they said, except as otherwise provided by law. And Justice Thomas keyed in on that introductory language to suggest that except as otherwise provided by law was a nod to Section 1400 as the sole venue provision for purposes of patent cases. I would note, and I think that Justice Thomas focused in on this as well, that for over 90 years, the courts have interpreted the patent statute to be outside of the general jurisdiction, or I'm sorry, the general venue statute, and read them as being completely separate. And it's only been in the last 25 years, since the 1990 v. Holdings decision, that courts have seen the general venue statute as modifying the specific patent one. So I think that this debate that we're having right now as to how these sections interact with one another is really the same debate that started back in 1893 when a venue statute was passed at that time. And it's been fairly consistent for decades that patent statutes have been seen as different from the general statute. So, and then finally, before I hand it back, I wanted to comment that in Justice Thomas's decision, one of the things he does is he cites to Justice Scalia and Brian Garner's book on reading law, and he cites to the portion of the book that deals with the presumption against implied repeal of statutes. And what Justice Thomas looked at this as the question of whether Section 1391 impliedly repealed Section 1400. Because if you go with the interpretation of the statute as suggested by Devlin, what you would do is essentially gut Section 1400. And in essence, you would be repealing Section 1400. There's a little bit of application that's left for Section 1400 because it also applies to individuals and other non-corporations. But for purposes of corporations, Section 1400 would be read out of the statute. And so Justice Thomas focused on, or he cited to that section of Justice Scalia's book, and it was a nod to Justice Scalia. And for the careful readers, I'd suggest going to that section of the book and reading, because I think that really shows the underlying rationale of Justice Thomas. Interestingly, in that section of the book, the first citation to anything was Justice Scalia citing to an opinion written by Justice Thomas. So in effect, Justice Thomas is citing back to his own discussion of statutory construction. And Justice Thomas goes in that case into an elaborate discussion of Federalist 78. So for those of you who are Federalists and those who are textualists, I think that's where a lot of the meat of the textual opinion is. And so with that, I'm going to hand it back so that we can open it up for questions.
Great. Professor Devlin, would you like to respond?
Yeah, sure. So I'll respond to the point about gutting Section 1400 if under the Federal Circuit's read of the statute. And this is a point that was made in the amicus briefs and by one of the parties. And as Bill mentioned, I'm glad that it would still have action as far as with individuals. But I think the real answer there is what happened was, and this is spelled out if you read the ALI thing that I mentioned earlier, is that it's rather than go in and rewrite 200 special venue statutes that are dispersed throughout the U.S. code, Congress decided that it was easier just to put the definitions in 1391 and only have to do one amendment, and then make it doubly clear that those definitions apply to all of the special venue statutes that turn on residents. So I agree that it does render it like partially superfluous, I would say, but it still does some work, one, and two, it just is, from a realist standpoint, it's much easier to change the definition in 1391C than it is to go through the code and find 200 special venue statutes and change those. And it's as far as being a textualist, I would say, you know, if you didn't know about Forco Glass, if you didn't know VE Holding, if you didn't know the history of venue and patent cases, and you picked up the U.S. Code and you turned to Section 1391, I think it the clear reading of it is that it applies, as it says, to all civil actions brought in the courts, and the definitions of residency apply for all venue purposes. So it seems you almost have to know the history before you would even second guess the what it says on its face.
Yeah, this is Bill. The only response that I would make to that is that I think that when courts are construing statutes, they have to understand what the structure and function and how they functioned in relation to one another. I would say one of the criticisms of an awful lot of the briefs, the amicus briefs, and even a portion of our brief, we noted it when we were doing it, but a lot of them were consequentialist arguments, which is to say they were criticizing the statute based on how the parties had applied the statute and how the courts had applied the statute. And they said because it reached a result where a lot of parties were able to file cases where they preferred to file them, that somehow was an argument that the statute had been construed improperly by the courts. And that's another section of the Scalia and Garner book that's worth looking at. There's a portion of the book that talks about the half-truth that consequences of a decision provide the key to sound interpretation of a statute. And they call it a half-truth because according to Justice Scalia and Professor Garner, when you're looking at whether a statute has been construed properly, you should look at what it does internally, how it is consistent with its own language, with the other parts of the statute, how it interacts with the language of the statute. Those consequences are proper things to consider, but the real world consequences as to how individuals and people out there in the world are impacted by that construction isn't an argument or a proper argument for whether it was construed properly. And a great deal of the arguments that people were making, policy arguments as to why the Federal Circuit's interpretation should have been adopted, were based on those consequences. And I think those are policy arguments that are better left to the legislature to determine rather than the courts exercising policy discretion by contorting a statute. But I finally would go back to say, with respect to Devlin's comment, I think that the VE Holdings decision, if you go back and look at it, it's difficult to look at that language where it says for purposes of venue under this chapter, and it gives a definition, and Section 14 is under that chapter. I think it's really hard to deny that language. And so I think what the Federal Circuit did back in 1990, and this case really need to be reconciled. But this case that came down this week, TC Heartland, doesn't do that. It kind of brushes over those issues. Final comment is, it's notable in footnote one of the case, this holding applies to domestic corporations. And what's really notable is that TC Heartland is not a corporation. It's a limited liability company. And the footnote one suggests that in the complaint, Kraft Foods had alleged that TC Heartland was a corporation, and TC Heartland admitted that. And so that might have been a Scrivener's error, or there might have been a change or some unclarity, but that's the only reason this case is here before the Supreme Court, is because of the way that the complaint was drafted and an answer that admitted that they were a corporation. If they had denied that they were a corporation, it seems they wouldn't have grounds under this section, or even the way it's been construed now. TC Heartland wouldn't have these grounds, wouldn't need to be here. So it's an interesting practitioner's issue, just about being careful about allegations in a complaint, or in responding to complaint, looking for the tactical advantage you can get by admitting something that you don't necessarily agree with, so that you can accomplish something you want. So with that, I will hand it back over.
Great. Let's go to audience questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Let's go to our first caller.
Hi, this is Paul Salamanca at the University of Kentucky. Thank you very much for your presentation. I have a question that comes from, I guess you could call it the realm of judicial supervision or judicial economy. Courts have historically had the power to exercise discretion in such ways as to control manipulation of their docket. Is it possible that the Supreme Court, without saying so aloud, has essentially taken this opportunity to respond to what they perceived as an improper manipulation of the venue docket? So this could perhaps be analogized to a form of separation of powers analysis.
This is Bill. Bill Brown. I'll respond to that, and if Devlin wants to, I think that's right. In the brief that I wrote, I had a whole section that discussed motions to change venue and statistics on motions to change venue. And when we looked at the data on that, it said that even meritorious motions to change venue in the Eastern District of Texas, it was taking more than a year to get your motion to change venue granted. And sometimes they would happen later in the case, but we also looked at the time from the motion filing to grant of, and again, this is a meritorious motion under the old standard, right? And the old standard is that these are companies where they lacked minimum contacts in that district. And they were finding that in that Eastern District of Texas, it was taking more than half a year from the time the motion was filed to get it decided, and it was well after a year of litigation to get those decided. And then those cases, that decision as to whether you're going to grant a change of venue is subject to an abusive discretion standard. And so when I saw that, I thought it was striking because it appears to be a systematic abuse of discretion. And I thought it was outrageous. But going back to your question as to whether in terms of supervisory role, is the Supreme Court kind of reining in the abuse by the courts? I think as a practical matter, they are, but there's no indication in any part of the decision that would suggest that the court was overtly doing that. But I think that the court does rough justice here, and I think that might explain why it was an 8-0 decision. I would think that someone like Justice Alito might have disagreed with this and might have agreed with Professor Hartline's points that he made, or at least may have pointed out these difficulties, but none of the justices did. So I think it is some policing that is going on here in terms of the district courts that are being running roughshod.
Thanks, Bill. Yeah, this is Devlin, and I'll chime in too. There has been a trend in the Supreme Court, at least going back to the eBay case with injunctions, and I would call it an anti-troll stance, where they either explicitly or implicitly are thinking, you know, what is this decision going to do for patent trolls? So we have decisions on enhanced damages, we have injunctions in eBay, we have Section 101 patentable subject matter decisions, we have attorney fee shifting. There's been a lot of opinions that you could look at and say that, you know, sub silentio, the Supreme Court is trying to rein in the trolls. So, and it's interesting too, and this ties into another point I wanted to bring up, which is the idea that the court has also said that we shouldn't have special rules for patent cases, and it struck down federal circuit opinions where they had a special rule, and they said no, patent cases are just like any other cases, and so we're not going to have a special rule. But I would say that here it actually does the exact opposite, because the rule generally is that a domestic corporation can be sued anywhere that the court has personal jurisdiction. And that analysis goes to the full extent of the due process clause. So if it's a nationwide enterprise, it could potentially be sued for other torts anywhere in the United States. But what the Supreme Court has done now is made a far narrower rule if it's patent law. So I would say that now we have a special rule in patent law that doesn't line up to the rule that we have in other cases. And interestingly, though, I will point out that I think there's an asymmetry here because you have declaratory judgment action. So maybe an alleged infringer sues first to get a declaratory judgment of non-infringement or invalidity. And so the question there is, well, does 1400B apply there? Can they only sue the patent owner in its state of incorporation, assuming the patent owner is a corporation? And I don't think it works that way. I think that for a declaratory judgment, you actually would sue under 1391. And so it would mean that an alleged infringer will actually have a lot more choices of where it can sue to be declared a non-infringer versus where the patent owner could sue. So now there's this asymmetry created by the court. And interestingly, I didn't hear anybody complaining about this when they were arguing for TC Heartland side. but if you look historically, Congress has extended where corporations can be sued. And this goes back over a century. There's a long history of expanding where they can be sued. And now it's actually at the fullest extent of where they could be sued as far as the Constitution is concerned. Congress couldn't make it broader if they wanted to. Yet the court is saying, well, when it's a patent infringement case, it's very special, and so we're going to do it very narrowly. And I don't think that this matches up to the reality of modern interstate commerce. I don't think it matches up to what Congress has consistently done in expanding venue. The fact is that many corporations don't just operate in their state of incorporation. They operate across the nation, and Congress wanted these corporations to get both the benefits and the burdens of the law. And the burdens of the law means if you enter into a jurisdiction and are doing business, well, you get the benefits of the law, but you also get the burdens. If you break the law in there, then you can be sued there. And this has long been considered to be fundamentally fair. So I think it's unfair in the patent context that now we have this narrow rule. With that, I'll turn it over.
Yeah, this is Bill. Just to comment further, I think the point about what's been referred to as patent law exceptionalism, the notion that there's special doctrines or special rules for injunctions or finding preliminary facts or other issues that the Federal Circuit has developed over the last few decades. And in several cases over the last decade, the Supreme Court has stepped in and slapped the Federal Circuit and told them, no, you don't have a special rule for procedure or law or general principles. Apply what applies to all other cases in your cases, in your law, and develop law and have it be consistent with that. And so if you've developed a special rule, we as the Supreme Court are going to look askance at that. And Devlin is correct that this case seemed like it was one where there's a special venue rule that exists. And I don't know if it's a principle that's going to carry on that you can rely on in trying to predict what's going to happen in cases, because this certainly is out of step with that trend. Because in this case, the Supreme Court says, no, it's okay to have a special rule for patent cases. And maybe it's because that special rule was had, you know, 90 years of statutory legacy ahead of it, or maybe just because it wasn't a rule that was developed by the Federal Circuit over the last few decades since the Federal Circuit was created in 1982. So it certainly is a data point to look at when you're trying to see what philosophy exists at the Supreme Court when it's reviewing the Federal Circuit.
Let's go to our next question.
Hi, this is David Taylor at the SMU Dedman School of Law in Dallas. And I really enjoyed the presentation. I was interested in your thoughts about taking this case in the context of the Supreme Court's other patent cases and what this means for the Supreme Court as it views patent law, and in particular with respect to the patent eligibility cases, Bilski, Mayo, Alice, and Myriad, in the last 6 or 7 years. It seems to me that Justice Thomas and then Justice Scalia before he died weren't really applying the same textualism they might apply in other areas of the law. They're not applying those in the cases that are patent cases. And I'm wondering what your thoughts on that are and why that might be, if you agree with me.
Do you want to take that, Devlin?
I just have a quick comment on that. Thanks for asking, David. It's interesting because, well, first of all, as I hopefully made clear at the beginning, I disagree that this is textualism because I think the text is clear going in the other direction. But I concede that 8-0, I'm wrong. But this gets to Bill's point, is why didn't anybody else chime in and at least with a concurrence and say, yeah, okay, maybe it's not quite as easy as Justice Thomas made it out to be. And I honestly don't know. It's hard to divine what was going on at the court, but it seems like they really just phoned this one in. And in some ways, I have to wonder if it's because of the 101 cases where they maybe said too much and people will find something they said in passing and focus on that. And maybe they're a little worried that, everything we say can be used against us in a court of law because it probably will. So I have to wonder if they were just like, let's just be, I think the whole opinion is, 10 pages long. I think they were just going to say, we said it in Forco, we meant it, Congress didn't change it. It has to do more if it wants to change Forco and leave it at that. And we're not even going to discuss the other issues, except for in a footnote. I really do think that they, in some sense, they obviously know the effect that their opinion is going to have. And in some sense, they are basically legislating from the bench. And they know that the position that they took will have a negative effect on, non-practicing entities, particularly the patent assertion entities or the trolls. So even though they don't mention that, I do have to think that that's part of it. But honestly, I'm surprised that they didn't give Kraft Foods' position and the two opinions from the Federal Circuit, VE Holding and the opinion below. I'm surprised they didn't give it more discussion.
Yeah, David, I think that's a good observation on your part because I grappled with that as well because I thought from a textualist standpoint, like I said, I think it's unsatisfying because the way that the case was teed up, it was a case that really you had to get in and dig into it and it would be a great case study in how do you do statutory construction when you have cases that were statutes that conflict in such a way. And remember, these were very minor changes to the words. It wasn't very many words that they had changed in 1988 and that they had changed in 2011. And I think that's why Justice Thomas relied on what he did. And I think, Paul from University of Kentucky, I think it goes back to his comment. Maybe they were just reining in what they saw as an abuse of the system down there, and they weren't going to they obviously couldn't articulate it that way. So it's either that or they don't care that much about this area. I don't, it's hard to read what it is and make sense of it. But, when you do in the Bilski, Mayo, Alice and Myriad cases, and then you look at this case and also the Teva case that came out, I think a year or two ago, you look at those cases and it's hard to say that this is a strict, textualist case. I mean, especially like Justice Alito, when you look back at his case, there was a case a few years ago involving, when a party could or couldn't appeal and how many days they had to appeal. And Justice Alito looked at it was Code of Civil Procedure or the Rules of Appellate Procedure. And he looked at it and he just said, the words are what they are. You read them on their face. And if it's clear enough on its face, you don't have to go any further. And I think in this case, because of the history and the structure, I think you do have to go further to get to the right answer. But I think you have to explain that. in what you did. And the rationale that Justice Thomas relied on, again, was the question of whether there was an implied repeal of Section 1400 because you added a few words to Section 1391. And so that part fits in well. And I would commend the reading of the section of that Justice Thomas cited on section on page 331 of the Scalia and Garner book, because I think that's where you find a lot more of the true support in there. And perhaps Justice Thomas didn't want to overtly dig into his own cases and repeat the stuff if it's been said well enough. And I think that Justice or Professor Hartline's comment is that if the Supreme Court gets in on these thicket cases and makes a bunch of random comments, you know, those comments turn into whole lines of cases and briefs and other things. And so there is some beauty in the brevity of this case, is that they decide a difficult case in what seems to be a pretty clear way. It's unsatisfying, but it doesn't create any more mischief, is probably what can be said that's great about this. It doesn't create any more mischief. And then there's other issues that are going to come up, like we're going to start looking at the issue of whether what's sufficient for purposes of having a regular and established place of business. And that might be the hook that the parties are looking for to get venue in places that they want to go.
I teach patent law, and I have to say that those 101 cases, you know, we read all those cases, and I'm like, okay, what's the rule? Well, I can tell you the two-step Mayo-Alice test, but I don't know how to apply it to a new fact pattern. It's fairly incoherent, I would say. So the nice thing about this opinion is that it's easy to apply. A domestic corporation resides in its state of a corporation. There's your answer. So I appreciate that. And we had a similar thing in SCA hygiene with latches, and the court laid down a bright line rule. There's no latches. So it's I have to say, from the pedagogical point of view, that I do appreciate having a nice, easy rule to apply. I'll pick up on what Bill said about, you know, some people are saying that, you know, this is it. You know, they reside in their state of incorporation. That's the end of the analysis. But Section 1400B, as Bill mentioned, it has a second half. And it says that you can sue for patent infringement where the defendant committed acts of infringement and has a regular and established place of business. Well, that regular and established place of business analysis hasn't gotten a lot of focus ever since VE Holding 1990, because Resides was doing a lot of the work. But I think now, obviously, people are going to be turning to that. What does it mean to have a regular and established place of business in addition to the state of incorporation where they can be sued? And interestingly, the Supreme Court here didn't say anything about it. And that kind of ties in with, they were just going to answer the question before them and not try and open any can of worms. But I did a little bit of research into this, and I found a case from the Southern District of New York in 1960, Jacobson Manufacturing. And the court says, well, merely doing business in a district is not sufficient to confer venue. You have to have something more. It must appear that the defendant is regularly engaged in carrying on a substantial part of its ordinary business on a permanent basis in a physical location within the district over which it exercised some measure of control. And so the court there held that merely registering an agent for service of process was not enough. Fast forward to 1985, and so we have the Federal Circuit in Recordis Corporation say this, which I think is really interesting, that the appropriate inquiry is whether the corporate defendant does its business in that district through a permanent and continuous presence there, but it's not whether it has a fixed physical presence in the sense of a formal office or store. So even though somebody doesn't have a physical building within a district, it seems that under the reasoning, at least of that case, that you could be sued in that district, say if you had maybe an employee or somebody who lived there, and maybe they work out of a home office or You know, nowadays people work out of their cars. Something like that could establish jurisdiction in a different district. So I think it's going to be really interesting now that I think a lot of people are going to be focusing on the second half of 1400B and trying to figure out the limits of establishing venue under that.
Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. While we wait for the next caller, I'll make a quick announcement. Our next Teleform conference call is scheduled for Tuesday, May 30th. That call will feature Hans von Spakowski, manager of the Election Law Reform Initiative and senior legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation. He will join us to discuss the recent Supreme Court decision on redistricting Cooper v. Harris. Reminder to keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming Teleform calls, and you can also consult the full schedule of our upcoming calls on the Federalist Society's website, fedsoc.org. Also available there are podcasts of previously recorded Teleform calls you may have missed. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Not seeing any questions from the audience, I'll ask one of my own. You mentioned patent trolls before. Do you think this ruling will keep so-called patent trolls out of the Eastern District of Texas? I know you said that the caseload has already declined. Where will they go?
So this is Bill, at least one suggestion, which seems to create another problem, is that an enormous number of businesses are incorporated in Delaware, and Delaware already has a large number of cases, and I think that Delaware actually had per authorized judge. It had more, in 2014, proportionately to the number of assigned judges, Delaware actually had more cases. It had 235 cases per assigned judge. It's gone down a little bit, but it's still way above the other districts. And it may be that a lot of the cases, the plaintiffs, if they have the ability, are going to go to the District of Delaware, or the cases that are currently in Texas are transferable to Delaware. And Delaware is seen in a lot of ways as a welcome place to go for the patent trolls or non-practicing entities. And so those businesses or those plaintiffs may be taking their cases there, and a lot of the cases may be transferred there. And so some of the problems that you have in these places were with congested dockets and a plaintiff-friendly environment, that's probably still going to exist, and it's just going to create more of a – at least one of the criticism was that we've created these small number of specialized courts where parties are forced to litigate as defendants. Well, that problem is still going to exist if a lot of those cases are going over to Delaware. But clearly, many of the non-practicing entities or other even practicing plaintiffs are going to be forced to sue in the home turf of the defendant. And that's why people who are serious about protecting patent rights and creating an even playing field are really concerned of going to the hometown. You know, if you're going to sue some big corporations, especially ones that don't have retail arms out there. You know, the Apples of the world, they've got Apple stores all over the country. And so that seems like those are established places of business. And so they can be sued there. But some manufacturers that are very big are going to be forced. You're going to be litigating in their home turf. And so that's one of the criticisms that exists.
This is Devlin. So there's a very interesting paper, a study done by professors Colleen Chen and Michael Risch. The paper is called Recalibrating Patent Venue. And they actually look at this very issue. What would TC Heartland mean for plaintiffs? And what they found was that 42% of the total cases filed by operating companies, NPEs, PAEs, everybody, would not have to move, could have been filed where they were filed. I think they looked at 2015 data, but that 58% would have had to have been filed somewhere else. And they actually broke this data down, and they said for non-practicing entities, that 40% of the cases could stay in place, but 60% would have to move. And so then the question is, well, where are they going to move to? And as Bill alluded to, the District of Delaware is an obvious place. And I think this Chen and Rich study found that about 25% of MPE cases would be filed in Heartland, which is a very significant increase over the 7% that were actually filed. So we might have a quarter of the MPE cases going there. But then there'd also be another, in fact, a percentage-wise, a much larger uptick in the Northern District of California. They predicted that 17% of MPE cases would be filed there. Well, Bill said that, if I heard him correctly, that the District of Delaware is patentee-friendly. And I don't know that that's necessarily true. I've heard that it's less hospitable to patent owners, particularly non-pharmaceutical ones. So I think it will be interesting to see how those two districts are viewed. And it seems pretty obvious that the Northern District of California is, I would say, very much less hospitable to patent owners. And this is a point that we made in our amicus brief filed in the case was that, you know, cases are still going to be concentrated. And at least according to this study, there'll be five jurisdictions where the vast majority of cases are filed. And just as a policy matter, that this is not a big shift. And from my point of view, if people thought the Eastern District of Texas was too patentee friendly, I see cases moving into jurisdictions that might be too infringer friendly. And so I don't understand how that's necessarily a better thing. And it's also not clear that Delaware is going to be able to handle all of these cases, just as a practical matter. But more fundamentally, just as a matter of due process, I didn't, and to this day, I don't understand the big deal about the Eastern District of Texas. People are getting sued there because that's where they're infringing. And all the talk about forum shopping, it seems to me that forum shopping happens with anytime anybody sues, you're going to sue where you think you have the best shot of winning. And there's nothing special about it because it's patent owners doing it.
Yes. So this is Bill. I mean, I would comment that, traditionally plaintiffs within the law have had some discretion as to where they could file their cases. But I think that a lot of companies that get dragged to faraway places that they seem to have no connection to other than their products having flowed there seems a bit unjust to them. And it's, that's kind of the policy argument. And I think that these arguments about the tinkering with the levers of policy and what impact it's going to have on the parties, those are decisions that are particularly well suited for the legislature, and that the court really shouldn't be putting its thumb on the scale in favor of one side or the other to try to get a result. Theoretically, they should be looking at the statute and construing it, especially in the area of patent law, because Congress has been relatively active in this area in legislation over the last decade, and they're considering legislation right now to fix this what is the perceived problem. And there's a statute, a patent venue statute that was a bill that was going through the Senate, and it's been worked on a bit and has been proposed. And even since this week, since the TC Heartland case came down, some commentators have said that there's still additional work that needs to be done. What was really interesting in this case was that the Solicitor General didn't step in and comment at all. And one of the reasons why, my understanding is that they didn't step in and comment or take a position in this at the Federal Circuit. They didn't, because the standard under U.S. v. Cheney for a review of a writ petition is whether I think your your position as the petitioner or seeking a writ, you have to show your position is clear and indisputable. And I think that T.C. Heartland had a strong position and they were vindicated by the Supreme Court at the end of the day, I don't think they could say that their position under existing law at the time was indisputable. And so they had a tough time getting, you know, the Solicitor General to jump on board. And then once it was at the Supreme Court, T.C. Heartland had thought that the Solicitor General was going to come in on their side in the case, and they didn't. And so they stayed out of it and didn't take a position in the case. But this obviously has a huge impact on policy, and you know, patent holders felt like they haven't gotten a fair shake legislatively, and this is seen at least by patent holders as just another thing that's making it more difficult for them to monetize their intellectual property assets. Between Alice and the American Invents Act, with all the IPRs and the other decisions that have come down, and the cases that make it easier to get attorney's fees against a party who's litigating, all those things seem like the deck is getting stacked further and further against the patent holder. And the argument on the other side is that people perceive that there's been abuse of the system by patent holders through the non-practicing entities, the so-called trolls, abusing the system and shaking down companies. Last note on this point was that the Texas Attorney General was the lead lawyer on a brief of several attorneys general from numerous states, and might have been 8 or 11 states, that wrote an amicus supporting T.C. Heartland in this case. So the Texas Attorney General was taking a position that the venue statute should be changed such that less cases are going to go to the state of Texas. That was a very interesting point, and it suggests that at least the Solicitor General and the Attorney General in the state of Texas and other people in Texas feel that it's more beneficial for Texas to be seen as a business-friendly place than as a place to bring your lawsuits to sue companies from around the country and around the world.
Well, would either of you like to make some closing remarks?
This is Bill. I'll make a final remark, and then I'll hand it over to Devlin. I think it'll be interesting to see in the upcoming weeks what the trial courts do with T.C. Heartland and the motions to dismiss. I'm in the Central District of California, which is either the largest or the second largest district in the country, and we have disproportionately low number of patent cases relative to the number of judges and the amount of commerce we have here. And that's one of the reasons why this Bar Association asked me to write this amicus brief. And what's interesting to me is that I'm working probably this week on one of my cases and trying to get it transferred out of this district based on the T.C. Heartland case. There's a perception that there will be more cases coming to the places where the businesses are located and not be filed in these backwoods districts. But I think that in the end, in practice, the lawyers and the parties might figure out other ways to get to places that they want to get to anyway. So I think we should keep our eyes out on how this law develops and how the parties react, because sometimes it's different than what is predicted when you're trying to get the policy to change.
Thanks, Bill. This is Devlin. I'll just second that. It's going to be very interesting to see the cases that have already been filed and are underway, what the courts are going to do with them, especially cases that are further along. I'm sure a lot of lawyers have been pulling out the federal rules of civil procedure and brushing up on improper venue and whether or not they've waived their objections or whether or not they can seek leave to amend and try and get the case kicked somewhere else. And it'll be interesting to see too whether the courts are just going to dismiss the case, and in which case the patent owner would have to sue somewhere else and start over, or whether they'll just simply transfer the case to somewhere that actually has venue. And secondly, it'll be interesting to see what happens with all the legislative proposals, like the Venue Act, whether these are going to be put on the back burner now that the Supreme Court handed down TC Heartland. And it's interesting, too, because I was against the Venue Act when I had the law on, my side. I don't understand why we're treating patent owners differently. Why don't we just apply the rule that applies to any other plaintiff in federal court? Now I'm looking at the Venue Act and thinking, well, that's actually a lot more reasonable than the rule that we have now under TC Heartland. So I don't think it's going to go away. I still think that adjustments are going to be made and hopefully, in my opinion, adjustments that give patent owners more choices of where they can sue. And I just want to say thanks again to the Federalist Society for having us, and thanks to Laura for hosting and moderating.
Likewise. Thank you for everyone for participating on an afternoon before holiday weekend.
On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.